Hot, buildings ablaze, you grab a lead, you get a fight. You think to yourself, probably, this might be a good night. It hit me too as the Leafs were leading that game, and I was actually texting with some friends about it, how you had that 1-0 lead against a team that was missing three key pieces, and the urgency level went up that the Leafs were really going to have to play a tight hockey game and really couldn't afford to lose that one. Like, here's how it stands right now. They're 4 points back of the Florida Panthers. Yes, they have a game in hand. Yes, they have two games against the Panthers still to go this season. Certainly not done with the Atlantic Division and the potential to lead it, but there's 17 games left. It's not a long runway here for the Leafs if they continue to stick playing this way, if they are going to continue to slide like this. You want to be hot at the right time, right? And that's playoffs. You really would like the momentum, though, of going into the postseason, not only to avoid the matchup, but to be feeling really good about your game. And right now, it's really tough to be looking at it this way. And it's disappointing because coming out of the Four Nations, right, and even before it, and I think for the most part this season has been one of real optimism for Toronto fans. And I know that that's kind of the thing that they get drilled for over and over and over again is playing the parade, right? It's playing the parade whenever this team is doing well and whenever this team is playing a certain way. And God, how many years have you tricked yourselves into thinking something was different, right? Okay, fair enough. But if you are a close observer of this team, then you do know there were real hallmarks with this group that were different than past iterations. And I've gone over them a million times, so we don't really need to just like go through the checklist, but they're the same reasons why they were so aggressive at the NHL trade deadline. This group felt urgent, and there is certainly an urgency with the roster composition, right? And going into this stretch of play, you thought, okay, you're right there. You're right there in the mix. These other teams have loaded up, but you're going to do the same thing. And I kind of felt like post-deadline, you were really excited about where they were going to be, that they found ways to balance out their roster, and they looked like they were going to head into a stretch run with a little bit of added momentum, that level of urgency. And given the way that they had just like pulled games out all season long, a feeling like, hey, these guys could really do it. They could really win the Atlantic Division and set themselves up for something that's going to be different this season. But now, wow, how quickly things have changed. And I don't want to make it seem like I'm Chicken Little here, like the sky is falling. Again, ultimately, they're 4 points back of the Florida Panthers. There have been a lot of positives from this season. But lately, it's hard to ignore some of the warning signs with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I want to go over a couple of them before we bring on a couple of guests here. So first of all, I mentioned the record, but the Leafs are now 8-9 against Eastern Conference playoff teams. We just watched them play the Colorado Avalanche, and we talked ourselves into the idea that, hey, this brand new deadline acquisitions, and they were missing Chris Tanev, and that's the toughest place to play in the league, and they're so fast. They skated circles around them. Toronto couldn't possibly be ready for that. You're like, okay, Vegas. Hey, the Leafs got heavier at the deadline. Vegas is a big, heavy team. Again, you're missing Chris Tanev. You didn't get great goaltending. Goalie put you behind the eight ball. They got to pull Joe Woll in that game. All right. don't really panic about that one. Don't really worry about it too much. It's fine. It's all right. The Sharks game, whatever. They hadn't blown a lead all season long. It's the San Jose Sharks. Yeah, just kind of throw it away. But the opponents that are like real playoff style opponents, Colorado and Vegas, and then you get this Florida game. And you grab that lead. Like I mentioned, and Florida is missing Aaron Ekblad, and they're missing Matthew Tkachuk. And no, they haven't had Brad Marchand yet, and so it's tough to kind of project what he's going to look like in that lineup. But here's my guess, is that he's going to be pretty good for him, that he's going to be a pretty quality postseason player. That's just my hunch, you could call it. I think that everybody would pretty much agree with me. But yeah, they're missing those three guys, and they still find a way to play their game and get around the net and get timely saves and get timely goals and convert on the power play. And Toronto's sitting there at the end of that game a little stunned that they weren't able to accomplish anything. They didn't get a win. It comes with the silver lining of Max Domi played better, a guy who's been really, really, really disappointing this season. But yeah, for context, and I tweeted this last night, but it was late, and I'm going to bring it up on this show. Not only are the Leafs 8-9 against Eastern Conference playoff opponents, not only are they 4 points back now of Florida and a far smaller window of opportunity now to be able to jump them, got to figure that they're going to get real hot and divert from the way that they're playing. But the goal differential has always been a number that I like to look at, right? It doesn't always tell everything. It's kind of like PDO, where I look at that stat and I say, hey, it's helpful when trying to contextualize things, but it's not the be all and end all. But the Washington Capitals are plus 68. The Tampa Bay Lightning are plus 51. The Florida Panthers are plus 41. The Carolina Hurricanes are plus 32. I would say that's the list of contenders in the Eastern Conference this season. To me, it's just a bit of a stretch. I know the Senators are red hot right now, and they really do look threatening. And Columbus has this incredible momentum, and they've been playing awesome as of late as well. And you could squint. You could try to convince yourself that there's other teams in the Eastern Conference, especially, like, I'm not saying that they couldn't make it there, but those are the contenders, right? And then there's Toronto, plus 15. Plus 15 goal differential. And you've got to think about it in this context too, is this is a group that throughout this year, arguably was getting the very best goaltending in the NHL from their 1-2 punch. We were having lengthy conversations. Like, it started off, hey, does Toronto have a top two goalie tandem? Let's not get crazy, because other teams probably have better ones. And what does that mean in terms of the equation? And where do we go with this? Ultimately, they got unbelievable goaltending. You looked at their goals saved above expectation, and it was just, they were browbeating teams. They really were. They were arguably the best in the NHL. They were solid. They were terrific. They were protecting leads. There were some maybe inflated stats defensively, but ultimately you really did feel like they could close games. And plus 15, to not even be half of the next closest contender, I think is a little eye-opening. To be looking at these games against Vegas, Florida, and Colorado in this recent stretch and say, I don't know if they looked all that close. That's a little eye-opening. To be 8-9 against Eastern Conference playoff teams, that's a little eye-opening. And to the goaltending point of this, over this stretch, you would say, like, well, JD, they didn't get elite goaltending. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of think that's my point exactly. Sure, that's what it often comes down to come playoff time, is who's going to get the better goaltending? Hey, who gets hot? Who's not? It felt like a massive edge for Toronto. And I don't think these guys have been playing poorly, other than Wolf for the small stretch that he had there, like the two games back-to-back, where it just didn't really look good for him. I thought he bounced back in his last performance. But ultimately, when the Leafs' goaltending is not elite, when it's not great, it's just good, they don't look like a contender. They don't look like they're on the same level as those teams. That was a real advantage for them, and it's started to regress. And I don't think that they're the ones like to blame. I'm not trying to circle them and say, like, this is because the goaltending. My point is just simply, that was sort of the thing that was making them feel special. What's the other area where you feel that about them? Their blue line doesn't score. They're struggling to score 5-on-5. Their power play has been very up and down. Their penalty kill has been down this season. They don't have the identity of Austin Matthews from a night-to-night basis. In fact, he is far and away the biggest concern with this team. I thought that he was better last night, but ultimately he didn't score. He didn't score, and that's his primary job with this team. Yeah, he's the captain. He's got to have leadership, blah, 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 going down the line. Mike DiStefano tweeted this last night, and I almost fell off my couch. Like, I felt a little lightheaded. It's like that scene in Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels where the guy loses all the money at the casino, or sorry, at the illegal poker game, and he leaves the bar, and he's got to go tell all his friends, and they play that Pixies song, and he's, like, losing his balance, and he's just in a state of shock. Matthews hasn't been scoring 5-on-5 to this tune. He's got 1 5-on-5 goal in his last 16 games. Oh, 16 games? This is the guy that coming into this season was the number one 5-on-5 goal scorer in the NHL. And so, yeah, it's tough, man. It's really tough not to get a little chicken little, but boy, oh boy, last night was not good for the confidence of a fan base, the confidence of, I think, the preservers of this league, to see the Leafs ultimately fumble a game against a Florida team that was shorthanded and that they had the lead on and that they were on home ice for. Oof, not easy. Bill Lindsay played 13 seasons in the NHL. He's an analyst for NHL Network, of course, a former Panther. He joins me now. Hey, Bill, thanks for doing this, man. It's great to have you.
Yeah, no problem, JJ. Good to be on this morning.
Yeah, I hate that you had to hear me do a little bit of a rant because you're like, whoa, classic Toronto media guy, just lose a game and this is what you do is point out all the flaws of your team. I swear, I haven't been this much of a weather vane this season. It hasn't been this up and down, but the recent stretch for the Leafs has not been overly encouraging. And so you look at last night's game, and particularly through the lens of Florida missing some real key contributors for that team, and I'm curious what your biggest impression was from last night's contest.
I thought it was a heck of a hockey game. Well played between both teams. And the adaption, if you're looking at it, the Panthers are going to take away your time and space. They're not going to give you a lot. You're going to have, I was looking through some of the analytics, and Toronto dumped the puck in 70% of the time last night, which is a ridiculous amount. So you're going to have to play that dump and chase game. Can you work in on the forecheck? Can you create scoring chances? Well, Toronto at 5-on-5 got to the inner slot. Had 7 shots from the inner slot. The Panthers only had 1. So I'm looking at those kind of numbers, and you're talking about Austin Matthews in a game, and Paul Maurice has talked about it. The rush game is not going to be available very much throughout the course of the playoffs, very little. And that's why he designed our team to play like it does, dump the puck in, battle, get into that kind of just war of attrition down deep into the trenches. I thought Toronto did a really good job of that. And the Panthers are the best screen team in the NHL, getting bodies in front. Last night, no shots on net with a screen in front of the goaltender. Stolarz, the screen, the defenseman, you talked about their lack of scoring. Yes, that is something that's going to hurt them, but they prevented the Panthers from getting to the front of the net. So that's the good side of it. That's a playoff game, and that's exactly how it's going to be played. Now you have to find a way to maybe put a couple of more pucks in. But if you can play that kind of style and get those kind of results, I know the Panthers are missing players, but it doesn't matter much with this Panther group because everyone buys in and plays the same way. Sam Moskevich is playing brilliant. He's probably going to be one of the players that may have to step back once you get Marchand in the lineup. And it just came down to our power play was better than yours, and our penalty kill was better than yours, and it ends up being a too many men on the ice penalty that kind of cost you. But you had the fight and the hit from Domi, the first goal from Tavares. I thought it had every feel of a playoff game. And if I'm a Leaf fan watching that game, okay, yeah, we can grind it out with the best of them. It's okay.
Yeah, I do think that they've been able to employ that style better this season. I will say that it's a little surprising to hear that they had 7 slot shots in that game. And I'm like running through my head on what a few of them were.
Inner slots, right where you want it, to 1 for the Panthers. So.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And I'm thinking about a couple of them being like broken plays for Toronto, because the thing that really did bother me, especially in the third period when Toronto was chasing the game, was that I felt like their stars started to gravitate towards the perimeter. Matthews obviously had the one opportunity where he breaks in alone and he's right there on the doorstep. He puts it just like a little high, but for the most part, it was like, I didn't see Mitch Marner in those areas. They scored on a goal that is, I think, considered in that area where it's like, it's John Tavares where he gets that pass from William Nylander, but far too few opportunities for them at the net. So it's interesting to see them actually end up leading in that category,
can be said on the Panthers side. If you take out the power play scoring, I was watching that Panther team, and I'm like, yeah, we're not getting enough traffic at the net. Our players aren't getting to the front of the net as well. So if we were in the opposite position chasing that game and it had been flipped and you guys had scored on the power play or done something different and had a lead, I'd go, geez, this Toronto team is really taking away a lot of what we do. I understand it from the Panthers. We do that on a nightly basis. So that's the margin for error is very thin.
Yep, I totally agree. And you know what, though? When you're talking about margin for error in games like this, one of the things that also stuck out is the Panthers have been in all these games with high emotion. They've made Stanley Cup runs. And Toronto, in the past, they've had a bad habit of when they've played the Bruins, because that was the measuring stick game for them in the past. Now I think it has become the Panthers. It's that they've let the emotion of the game ride a little too high, and it's turned into bad penalties. And just these like small little details in a game. And again, I know that we're using the sample of a one-off game where both teams were pretty even on 5-on-5. But that is one to me where I go, well, the attention to detail and the emotion of the game has to be a little bit better. And you see David Camp try to skate through the crease and he takes a penalty and it hurts the momentum of a team in a big spot. You see Oliver Ekman-Larsson, who has been in those games, so I think kind of should know a little better. I know he's sticking up for his goaltender and he's trying to add like a physical element to his team and stick up for his players, but he sucker punches somebody in the face and it results in a power play goal. You mentioned the too many men penalty where Bobby McMahon skates to the bench and then kind of is a little absent-minded and decides to just sort of circle back and try to go into the offensive zone late on a change. And I do wonder, just from this season standpoint or from the Panthers in general, if you have seen that from them where it's like they play this extremely physical game, this tough game. They've got all these players that are considered rats in a very positive way to me. And yet in a game like last night, the dumb penalties for Toronto, I thought were maybe 3-1, but maybe 3-0, because the Panthers penalties I didn't feel like were as egregious.
Yeah, there's a point to that, which Paul Maurice is really – really pounded into that team. That first run on that first year when we went to the Stanley Cup against Vegas, we were just all emotion. We were in your face, in your grill. That's when the reputation started. And we went over the edge quite a bit during the course of that year. And it did cost them some. The playoffs, they were able to dial it down somewhat, not the whole degree. But going into the Stanley Cup year last year, they were talked about, okay, the emotion level, where we got to keep it, where the line is drawn and where we can and cannot go as far as taking that extra leverage. And it really set a tone throughout the course of the regular season. Once you got into the playoffs, the scrums, they understood, okay, if you want to instigate something, okay, do not retaliate. Do not retaliate. And that was the word just going around the room, because the person that retaliates is probably going to be the person that is always going to the penalty box. That was the case on the OEL penalty with the punch against Samuskevich when he just drilled him in the head for no reason. So once you get there and you're known and you have a reputation that the Panthers have as a team that's going to be in your face, is going to chirp, is going to hit, is going to do everything, but you understand the refs are watching, and that's where Paul Maurice and coaching this team, changing the identity, and then just nitpicking at little areas that they can get better at each season is where you start to see this Panther team. And that's one area they honed in on. And you're right, the emotions of the game, they're able to keep even keel. Big games, it doesn't matter what, especially when you go to a Game 7 of a Stanley Cup final. They're able to walk that line pretty well now without going over the edge.
Yeah, I've always felt like from Toronto's standpoint in that regard is, one, they haven't had that run like the Panthers where they have had to learn it the hard way. Like it's been mostly first round exits except for the one season where, of course, they were eliminated by the Panthers shortly after. But this idea that because their identity players don't play that way, they've felt this and they've been criticized many times over the course of this group for not having that edge or moments where they didn't stick up for one another, that there's been this added element of like, you got to prove how tough you are. And I think that's kind of dangerous in the sport when like you're the Panthers, for example, you've already got that reputation. You've already got that solidified of like, no one messes with us. We are tough. We go to those dirty areas. We're not afraid of a fight versus Toronto's, which is always feeling like you got to prove it in some way and how that can bubble up. And I'm curious because yeah, you are a former player. You played a long time in the league. Like how you feel a team's reputation or a team's identity in that regard can play into those moments.
Well, I've understood it a few times going into playoff series and going into Toronto. You want to make life miserable for Marner, Tavares, Nylander, Matthews, all those players. And you're not going to change the DNA of Matthews and Marner and the ilk. They are who they are. Mm-hmm. Can you get them to buy in defensively, dump and grind? Absolutely. You can put that into them. But as far as getting in there and just blasting with the checks or being chirpy, you either have that or you don't. So you have to really understand who you are. And there's different ways to get it done in this group, or sorry, this league, is just understand who you are and what your team is about. And I think Craig Berube is trying to get this team there to, okay, you guys, we have to dump the puck in, which they did last night. We have to grind down deep in the corners. We have to come out of it. What's the extracurricular stuff? We got some players that can handle that, but we don't have to go there. We can take the punches in the face. We can show toughness that way and just use our speed and our talent to draw penalties. You don't have to be. I mean, Gustav Forsling is one of the toughest players, or I believe maybe he takes pucks in the feet, in the skates. He's not fighting tough. But he is physically and mentally maybe the toughest player on the Panthers. He limps off so many times and is back for the very next shift. Now, there's a different kind of toughness that you're looking for from a player. Yeah. Can he battle through that attrition? And that's where you're looking for if you're in Toronto. Not so much the fighting or the hitting. How can these guys really get through traffic? Can they get mean down deep in the corners? Can they force themselves to the front of the net to create those screens, to get those rebound opportunities, to get to the blue paint? And that's, I guess, when you're the Panthers and the Leafs that haven't done it, you're saying, let's force these guys to see how they are down deep in the trenches, how they work, how they're going to be able to try and find their way to the front of the net. And once you've got there and proven that, there's no other way, at least another great regular season, but there is no other way to really prove your identity and that you can do that until you have playoff success. And that's why this year for this Leaf group that's been together a long, long time, this might be the last hurrah unless they're able to get something done in the playoffs.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And to the point on toughness, I think that's extremely well stated. Like you mentioned Forsling, and that's what Toronto has in Chris Tanev, right? Shot blocker.
Yep.
Doesn't hit. Like you look at his hits and they're always completely, it's like doesn't fight. Do think he can. Looks mean, looks real tough with the face and the lack of teeth, but ultimately his toughness doesn't come from, yeah, those exact same means. And when I think about toughness and when you're talking about those hard areas, it's hard for me not to think about, like, Toronto this season only has 2 goals, 6-on-5. And last night, when you're talking about, like, battling to those areas, kind of felt like not only was just Toronto struggling to gain the zone, and again, Florida's a tough team, so they deserve credit for these things when they go in on the half wall and they win a puck battle and they deny an entry. Those things are toughness. And for Toronto, when you're 6-on-5, you always want to feel like when you're watching it, you're the team that's trailing. Like there's real chaos around the net. Like there's a puck that's loose and guys are trying to jam it home and there's a screen. And for Toronto, it was just all perimeter. And I thought that's not toughness. Like that can be toughness for you, is in that moment, you feel like you're going to come up and you're going to be clutch and you're going to battle to those areas. And I think, honest to God, it was one of the most disappointing stretches of play for them in that entire game. And it's weird to isolate 6-on-5, but it really was for me. And so for Florida, I am curious too how – so they're a deeper team. They have been. Again, they're winners. You mentioned Paul Maurice and the confidence that does come with a group that's actually seen their style of play and their messaging actually translate into deep playoff success, a Stanley Cup, all of these different things. But – yeah, missing key components, and I know Marchand hasn't been there yet, so it kind of feels weird thinking about him as an addition, or like he's not, it's hard to call him a guy that's missing right now. But no Tkachuk, we've seen teams play great without their star players before. Like that's actually kind of common around the NHL for whatever reason, is like the team will step up in the absence of a star. But to be missing him and Ekblad, and then also knowing that Marchand is going to be injected in this group, what is it about this team that allows them to survive those major losses and still play like almost to a T to their identity?
Well, that defensive structure that Paul Maurice has put in place, that 1-3-1 through the middle of the ice, that wing lock is, when you watch it upstairs, it's like an orchestra as far as closing gaps, forcing teams to dump the puck in, to play to play your kind of style of hockey. Panthers, I can count on one hand where games have opened up and it's been blitzing back and forth. So they understand that neutral zone concept. You can put any player in now and they understand it. And they also understand once they go in that we're not going to be the team that does a lot of fancy stuff at the blue line. We know that we're going to have to dump it in. It's a very hard, demanding style. And that's why Bill Zito went out and got the players that he got. He's putting round pegs into round holes. He understands that what fits has to fit in the dressing room and has to fit our style of play. Brad Marchand, definitely, yes, check that box. You need a right-hand defenseman. Seth Jones, that definitely checks another box. So you're adding more depth along the way. You needed a little extra on the defensive side. Then the fourth line, again, Nico Sturm. Many teams might not address this. You're 23rd, 24th in the faceoff circle. You don't want Barkov taking the draws all night. Get a big, strong centerman to anchor your fourth line that can win faceoffs. And Nico Sturm is able to do that. So they leave no stone unturned. And if everyone gets into this lineup healthy, I don't know where Erod would fall down to, Samuskevich or Boakvist, but you would have Nico Sturm on that fourth line. And we had it last year. And then you could have Samuskevich and Boakvist, or Rodriguez and Boakvist, or you could have Gadjevich and Nate Noshek. You have two fourth lines, basically, and then you have those three guys up there, or three lines with all kinds of flexibility. You can put those nine forwards into any different slot, play with every different player. It happens all the time, and Paul Maurice will mix and match his lines constantly throughout the course of the season. So that's where the understanding comes, but all the bases. Paul Maurice has told me we've gotten really good defensively, and about a week ago, he said it was the first time that I ever talked to my team about what we can do offensively. He said every time I've just pounded defense, and let everything go from there. So that has just been the staple that they've worked around for the whole time Paul Maurice has been here.
Well, it's hard not to be envious of a team like that, where the feeling is, and of course, Marchand has the bona fides, and I think just about like anywhere that would have grabbed him, people would have said, wow, he's going to fit in seamlessly. Seth Jones was someone that obviously went through a really tough time in Chicago from a play standpoint. But he jumps there, Florida's just a team where when they grab those kind of guys, you look at it and even you mentioned those names and those fits and you just think, oh, damn, they're going to be able to optimize the talent and they're going to get the most out of those guys. And so for Seth Jones specifically, I think 28 minutes last night, just it felt like he was on the ice the entire time. He makes the one brilliant play that leads to the goal on the power play where Lawton can't get a clear because he's on his back and he tips a puck back into the zone. And yeah, they end up putting it in the back of Toronto's net. But what has he looked like so far to you? Because normally there's like an acclimation period that players have. I've had a bunch of guys on talking about deadlines. You know, I was talking to Keith Yandle and Christopher Stieg this week about how long it takes you to get up to speed and different styles of play and how long. Yeah. When do you feel like yourself? When do you get settled? Like Versteeg told me, like for him, when it happened, it was like a month and a half. And you watched Seth Jones last night, and I'm like, this looked like he has been playing there his entire career.
Acclimation comes in pretty easy with this locker room and what you're going to fit in. And Paul Maurice will explain. But Seth Jones comes from a situation where he's been just beaten and battered. From Columbus was okay, Nashville was okay, but the Chicago years, it just takes a toll. You come up here and all of a sudden, wow, you're on this really good team. I'm not spending my whole night in the defensive end, and I'm not asked to be doing everything. And the ideal plan was to come in and lower his minutes to 22, 23 a night, not be the QB on quarterback on power play number one. Well, that all changed once Aaron Ekblad got the suspension. So he's going to go back to those de facto 27, 28 minutes, but they're going to be a lot easier here in Florida. You're going to have the puck more. You're going to be able to skate up, be the extra layer on attack. So watching Seth Jones play with that long reach, it's just a natural fit to go there with Forsling. And then once Ekblad does come back and goes with Forsling, then he won't have those top minutes. But you know, the beauty of knowing that Seth Jones can play those minutes is just a luxury to have in your back pocket if you're Paul Maurice when Ekblad goes down. Well, we got a defenseman. We just traded for him. And he's very comfortable playing almost half a hockey game. He skates effortlessly. The reach is something that he uses. And I believe his offensive numbers are going to take an uptick here once he realizes and understands just the totality of this group. But to fit into that locker room and say the culture and the winning, so the acclimation going to a team that has been there, done that, is a lot easier from my personal standpoint as a player to fit in the dressing room, just knowing, okay, I just have my job to do. Do it. I'm not asked to do anything extra. Maybe that was in Chicago. I was asked to do this, to do that. No, everyone has a role here. Everyone has a part. And Seth Jones coming here, the adaption, we try and make it as easy as possible. And with Bill Zito, knowing him from the Columbus days, he knew him on the ice, but he also knew him off the ice as a person and how he would fit into our room. That's a big part of it. So it has been a seamless transition for Jones, and I believe it's only going to get better.
So, yeah, and not to mention, I do think that there is something to be said for, like you mentioned, the taxation of being in a place like Chicago, just in terms of like you always being in your own zone. But there has to be just a massive mental lift, too, from being in a place for a bunch of years that was just having absolutely zero success, is just finishing at the bottom of the standings year over year, to going to a place where it's like you're a contender again. Like even some of these guys, like, you know, Toronto grabbed Brandon Carlo at the deadline. And it's probably a little bit more difficult for him leaving Boston, a place where he has had success. He is going to a conference, or go play for a conference rival, a team that he's faced in the postseason. The feeling of like, damn, we had something in Boston. We just weren't able to get over the hump. We lost that one series to Florida. For Seth Jones, there's none of that. It's just like you pack your bags. You're extremely excited. It's not difficult for you whatsoever. You're thrilled to be going. You want it out of there, and you end up in just a perfect spot. And yeah, God, I think he finished a dash one last night, but he was incredible. Speaking of like the incredible guys, and this is the last Panther that I'll try to gush about, but like, God, Sam Bennett, what a contract year for this guy to have. And last night, same thing, where you see just an identity player for this team. And I'm kind of curious too, because like, I mentioned it, Florida can miss guys and they adapt, right? You lose Matthew Tkachuk and you adapt. But watching it last night, you just feel as though what an impact that he just makes shift after shift after shift after shift, and takes the one penalty, but I thought pretty much like a flawless game outside of that. And so I've got 2 points of curiosity with him. Is like, one, it really doesn't seem like Florida is going to be able to keep him because of just their cap situation and what he's going to be able to command this offseason. But yeah, I guess, not just like what kind of a loss he's going to be for this team, but what he means for this group in general.
He means a lot to this group. They're going to do everything to re-sign him. I don't know what hoops or that they're going to have to. You talked about us missing players. The one player that we do not fare well when he's out of the lineup, Sam Bennett.
Yeah.
He's the heartbeat. He drives with that intensity. When his game is on, it just reverberates throughout the dressing room, throughout the bench. It's such a hefty style, hard-nosed, and he's the trailblazer for everything that we're trying to do and trying to sort out. Matthew Tkachuk is part of that and has a different presence, but Bennett's the guy that plays mean. Like, he's angry. He's when you drop the puck, it's okay, it's game on. We're going to do everything. I'm going through the wall. Yeah. When I try to hit you, I'm not trying to bump you off the puck. I'm trying to throw you through the end of the glass. So when I'm coming hard to the net, I'm a freight train. You're going to have to try and stop me. And he has the ability to score and all that kind of stuff. So Sam Bennett means so much on the ice. We even saw he's a healthy scratch for Four Nations. Then he gets into the lineup and becomes a big-time contributor for Team Canada, and that doesn't get lost on anyone, and that's why he was picked for that Four Nation team. He, in my personal opinion, is the straw that stirs the drink. He's the guy that, in that lineup, when he's out, all of a sudden it's a little flatter, a little less jubilant, just not quite as much. So we'll see what happens in the offseason for Sam Bennett, but there's going to be a priority there. He is going to command a lot on the open market. Does he want to stay here in this organization? Mm-hmm. We would hope so, but you're talking about missing players, and when we've missed Sam Bennett because he's had injuries in the past, he is a real noticeable person when he is out of the lineup.
Well, you know, I like to do like just normal workplace comparisons with professional sports when I can, and Sam Bennett's just like anything that you do, whether it's like, you know, you're a mover, you know, you're an accountant, whatever. If you're surrounded by somebody in the office or out on the job site, whatever, who is intense and takes things seriously and just like is constantly working hard and doing their job and you're around them, it's hard to go the other way. You know what I mean? Like it's mm-hmm. hard to be lackadaisical or to check out or to not take things seriously when you're around someone who's doing things the right way constantly and bringing that. So when you're saying like he's the straw that stirs the drink, it's like, yeah, like it makes sense. And especially since none of it seems to be like for ulterior motives, he just seems like the definition of a hockey player. Like he is out there to play the game, to do things the right way, to agitate you, to be creative and find his way to the net and score huge goals. And yeah, like, God, he was such a treat to watch play for Team Canada. Like, I thought he was their second most important player in the championship game. Like, just the spark that he provided, again, constant feeling like his line was winning the matchup. And it felt the same way last night against the Leafs, where it's like, oh, yeah, he's out here again. Cool. This feels bad. This feels like they're winning the matchup outside of the penalty he took. But that's like at the end of the shift when he's tired and tried to get a little too cute. But, yeah, God, what a player. Hey, Bill.
Yeah.
Oh, no,
JD,
go ahead.
JD, last point on all those players is what you have when good teams become great, with you're talking about Bennett or Barkov or Matthew Tkachuk and your leadership, is that all the way from the start in practice, you're talking about Bennett, how hard they work. All of a sudden, the fear of failure does not become for yourself. Oh, man, I went home and played a bad game. So disappointed in myself. It becomes, man, I didn't quite do my job. I just let Tkachuk or Barkov and those guys down. So when you have that kind of mentality, it filters. You are playing for the guy beside you. That guy's playing so hard. That guy's playing so hard. And it just goes down. And you, all of a sudden you have this love and love that comes together. And you once when that's and that becomes the unselfishness part about it's not about me anymore. It's about that guy sitting next to me. He has a family to feed. He has to go home. And if I don't do my job, I am not helping him in his cause. So the fear of failure for the person beside you is when good teams become great, and we've been able to really establish that culture here.
I think that's perfectly said. Bill Lindsay, again, 13 seasons in the NHL, former Panther and analyst for the NHL Network. I really appreciate you taking time, man. I hope we do it again. Just I hope the circumstances are different and you come on, you're like, oh, see, Toronto's playing great. And that's why they won the next two games against Florida. Yeah.
You got to go through some ups and downs. We'll see how it all plays out. Yeah. The playoffs are funny, and you never know.
God, wouldn't it be something? Anyway, Bill, thanks for making time, man. We'll talk to you soon. There he goes, Bill Lindsay. So a few things there. One is just when you talk about that culture, two things on that. One is just the ability for guys to jump in the room and feel comfortable. That is one of the things about Toronto, is you're under so much more scrutiny, stress, pressure than when you go to a place like Florida, not simply because of the media, which I think it's just because there's a lot of it, not because of the criticism, but whatever. That's just my personal opinion. It's more to do with the depth of coverage, the amount of people that are watching you, the amount of people who are tweeting about you, the intensity that comes with that. But also, you know, you try to fit these guys in, and there's always the feeling of like, are they going to fit? Where are they going to fit? Is it the perfect fit? Like, who are they going to play with? How is it going to work? Versus Florida, where, yeah, we're talking about these guys and fitting them in. And it's just like, oh, yeah, automatic fit puzzle pieces is going to be great. But just the cultural standpoint, there is no pressure because they've won. Like, yeah, of course there's pressure to continue to win and to capitalize on a timeline, but you're not coming in with the same ghosts or like internal pressures or dynamics of a team. You can tell, like, the Panthers are going to be loose. They're going to feel more pleased with where they're at this point of the season. They're probably not as stressed out about trying to finish first in the Atlantic Division. There's going to be a confidence level that comes with them. But yeah, just like, you even look at their cap sheet and talking about the Bennett thing. And yeah, the state taxes. The taxes. But even just like without even looking at it, it's hard not to envision a scenario where this team tries to get overly creative and the player, despite a extremely lucrative market out there, doesn't at least consider strongly taking less money, even with the tax, to remain a part of that group. And God, that is just something when you have that, when you've got that desire from players to sacrifice in order to be a part of something. And yeah, it just hasn't, that's something that really hasn't been built here. Outside of, again, veterans who want to come home and finish their career here and finish playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs because it was always a goal for them and they wanted to be around their families as they age, whatever. Just not the same. Good. Yeah. Ugh. Like I said, I feel down on the team today. I like what Bill said about the 5-on-5 stuff. I did think that Toronto was fairly even 5-on-5. But again, it's harder to be optimistic when they just don't score 5-on-5 to say, well, there was some like good process, because ultimately this team is in desperate need of those kinds of results. And we've done the process thing with them over and over and over again. And it's like, yeah, ultimately, would you like to have it? For sure. But you need to come through in these games. You need to find ways to get over these humps. And last night was a massive test, and they did not pass it. I want to take a quick break. Please subscribe to this podcast. Leave 5 stars if you are listening on Spotify or on Apple. You can reach out anytime on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. Always like hearing feedback. Always like hearing from people. Got a lot of responses yesterday about the Ottawa / Montreal thing, which feels, yeah, less like a story today, as they fall behind the Panthers in the standings a little bit further, and you're not really worried about the opponent right now, right? Like, you're thinking more, hey, just give people reasons to believe that this is going to be different down the stretch. Anyways, one of the greatest gifts you could ever receive in professional sports happened, and the player who gave it was very candid as to why. That's next. So I did a segment, I want to say maybe 5-6 months ago. I think it was with Ennis, where we did the best things that can happen to you as a fan of a team that are outside of winning a championship. And it was like winning a draft lottery, right? Seeing those ping pong balls come down in your favor, the commissioner of the league, or I think it's usually the assistant commissioner of the league, that comes out and they've got your card in the envelope. You're like, yes. Oh, hope, hope, baby, hope. But I don't think we put this on the list. And it was sort of a pretty big oversight now, especially in the context of modern day sports. And that is, when a star player signs an extension with your franchise at under market value. And before you get your backs up, you're like, oh my God, this again. It's like, yeah, this again. But Josh Allen decided to take the most guaranteed money in all of football. And yet it was viewed by everyone as an incredible give back by this quarterback, because you know what? He could have gotten a lot more. $250 million guaranteed. And so, yeah, is a quarterback different than other sports? There's just no doubt about it. But I want to play this audio from Josh Allen, who did a Zoom call with Buffalo media, probably some national people jumped in here because he is that type of player, to discuss his contract extension and why he ended up settling on a number that was record-breaking from a guaranteed money standpoint, but was not record-breaking in terms of what it was going to pay him per season, and didn't put him into a territory that was breaking the mold, say, like some of the other players that we've seen in the league do. Let's hear it.
It didn't seem like, to my perspective, I was taking a whole lot less. But when the way that I make sense of it, when you start getting these fairly big numbers throughout the entire league, you know, it's weird to say this, but what's five more going to do for my life that I can't already do right now, right? So like it's not that crazy to me, right? Like I live a pretty good life, got a house, got a car, we're good, but I wasn't looking to absolutely kill them at every chance that I could. And I told my agent that I was like, hey, if this has any impact on the pack, or impact on the cap, I should say, let's figure out a way to not do that. So again, both sides were willing to move and change different things. And it was a pretty calm mannered negotiation is what I can say, at least what I can hear on both sides. So it was good.
So again, this guy is in a different boat than a lot of other professional athletes, right? Like, we can acknowledge that $250 million guaranteed is quite different than $100 million in the NHL. We can also understand that this guy Living in Buffalo, it's probably the cost of living is probably a little more soft, a little softer to live there and get the house that you want and deal with your day-to-day expenses. Even though it's certainly not the only place that he has homes. It also is nice when you are, I don't know if he's engaged or married yet. And I actually have no idea who his wife is. I know her name, Haley Steinfeld. I think that's right. Brandon probably knows. He's all over. He's a big Bills fan. He's like, oh, him and Haley. He's probably obsessed with their relationship. But it also is nice being with someone who is very financially comfortable. You got the dual income of these two stars. Again, couldn't tell you one thing other than about Haley Steinfeld, other than I found out that she's famous through when Josh Allen proposed to her and being on the very, very, very periphery of, like, Josh Allen had like an ex-girlfriend, I think, who tweeted something, a shot at him when he got engaged and then said she was hacked. But I don't know anything about her. I don't know anything about the relationship. All that is to say is, yeah, she's taken care of as well. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars between them. But that is such a good feeling. And for Buffalo especially, right? Like, that is the Buffalo Bills. This guy's playing in Buffalo. I like that city. I think it's fine. But it's not Paris, right? We can say that. It's Buffalo. When it comes to the most attractive markets and places to play, in the NFL, it's lower on the list, right? Just, we can say that. A Bills fan would say that, for God's sakes. There's no argument for, oh God, Buffalo, the crown jewel of the NFL. It's where everyone wants to be, like, as opposed to LA. Got it. I think it's probably a little bit more fun to be rich in Los Angeles or New York than it is, like, New York City, than it is Buffalo. Anyway, to hear that as a fan is not just thrilling and fun and makes you just want to root for a guy more, but look at what this does for him optically. This is a guy who has not won. All right. Ultimately, at the end of the day, is Josh Allen one of the best three quarterbacks in the NFL? In my opinion, yes. Maybe the lowest you could put him is four, right? That's it. Four. You're now really pushing it. This guy is spectacular. He is a human highlight reel. And I do not think that he has been the reason that the Bills have not been able to win a Super Bowl up to this point. He's decided that he wants to be in Buffalo so badly that he was willing to make a huge sacrifice to you and I and everybody else in the world. But to himself, he has that perspective of, what's $5 million going to do? You know what it does? It buys you equity amongst your fan base and your media group and around football and with your teammates in a way that is worth the money. And when he says, yeah, what can $5 million do? It's going to go to the rest of the roster, and the other guys on the team are going to know it. And when the other guys on the team are going to be asked to do contract negotiations, and yes, I don't think that that's going to apply to every single one of them. There are certain dudes who are going to come from different backgrounds, be in different financial situations, familial needs, whatever it is, and they're going to want to walk and they're going to say, sorry, I have to get the bottom dollar. This isn't going to extend to everyone, but there will be a player or two who does take less money. And part of that is going to be because of Josh Allen, or the Bills will be able to spend a little bit more money than they normally would have on a guy because they have that extra Josh Allen money. But everyone in that locker room is going to know about it. Everybody on the Buffalo Bills is going to know about it. And it's hard not to think about Toronto right now in the context of Vladdy and Mitch Marner specifically, and not just Mitch Marner, because the other guys did it too. And that is the one part that isn't fair to Mitch, is Nylander and Matthews both have done the exact same thing. Hey, every single dollar, please. Maximum dollars. And as much as William Nylander's deal ended up being like the best one for Toronto, the first deal that he signed, he ultimately did sit out half of a season. And it sort of gets forgotten in all of this talk about like how Mitch is the most selfish of the core three. Like, nah, they all did the exact same thing. They've all been the exact same way. And by having none of them ever set that standard, they've all acted the exact same way in those negotiations. But my greater point here is, yeah, $100 million over 8 years is very different than Josh Allen getting $250 over, I think, a smaller time frame. I don't even think he's an 8-year deal. I don't know, Brandon, you probably know that off the top of your head. But Yeah, it's a big different money. But the number that he talked about, the what's $5 million going to do differently, right? That has to be. Like, this has been one of the frustrations with people in this market is I would love to know to some of these guys, like, what is that money actually doing differently from you? Like, what is it that is changing your life so much that taking that $5 million less over the course of a contract, right? Or for Mitch Marner's sake, right, it would be taking $1 million less over 8 years. So $8 million. What is it in your life that is changing from a like genuine lifestyle standpoint, a happiness standpoint, whatever it is? Because I, for the life of me, can't really figure it out. And Josh Allen has that perspective, and God, that's got to feel good. And it's the same with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Hey, man, I know that you're winning this negotiation right now in terms of the public perception, I think, from the most part. Again, I have seen a lot of people going, this is crazy. He's being offered so much money, just take it. But when we're talking about closing this bridge, right, and if it's $3.5 million, if you're Vladdy tomorrow and you come out and say to them, you know what, it was $500 million, but actually it's $480 million, and the Jays are at $450 million, like, did that not get things, does that not get the ball rolling? Does that not change your perception in the city as well? Like, when you get this contract and you struggle for a little bit, people get to look at you and say, hey man, this guy did come back to the table and lower his asking price by $30 or $20 million. And that is a huge, 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 huge amount. I get it. But it's also like you're getting paid $480 million guaranteed over the course of your life. You could be like halfway to a bill. It'd be nice if just some of these guys figured out that that quote that Allen gets to give, it's not free. It buys you the love of everyone who watches you. Anyways, let's take a quick break. Let's come back and let's talk to Luke Gazdick. How about the boys playing Wheat Kings to bring me back during a show where I've been mostly fired up? I don't know if that's like a dart to my neck. Like, hey, calm down. Things aren't so bad. That's young guys for you right there. That song is not to them what it is to most of us that are listening to this, because I assume most people listening to this are a little bit older. Okay. Leafs lose. A crusher to the Panthers. I mentioned it. It's like, it's one of those games where there was going to be a swing, not just in the standings, but from a narrative standpoint. Because yes, there were things that the Leafs did well 5-on-5 in that game. Yes, it does come down to power play, but also power play, as we all know, has been a bugaboo for this team. And I didn't think that, like, people have always like criticized like, oh, the coaches. Like, last night was, to me anyways, just some real sloppy stuff from the Leafs on the power play. And sometimes you do wonder if in these big spots, like, part of what has not worked for them isn't the strategy that they're employing, but if they get tight in those spots, especially when they're not scoring 5-on-5, and there is that added feeling of like, oh my God, we have to get one here. But yeah, now in the light of this loss to Colorado, where they didn't look like they were anywhere close to that team, despite being up on them. That loss to Vegas, where, sure, bad goaltending, but you got your asses kicked, and you also didn't look close to them. And now you lose to the Panthers. Now you're 8-9 against Eastern Conference playoff teams. Now your goal differential is shockingly far apart from the other contenders in the Eastern Conference. And this is the way that the narrative is going to swing. Anyways, Luke Gazdick of the NHL on Sportsnet, former NHL forward. He joins me now. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
Good, JD. How you doing, man? I, for one, love the Wheat Kings intro. Felt like I was at my cottage in Parry Sound, sitting on the dock until mid-July.
Yeah. No one's saying it's bad, Luke. Everybody, who doesn't love that song? Let's don't misconstrue my position on this. I'm with you. But yeah, you listen to Tragically Hip. That song is like you're at the cottage and you're sitting there having a quiet night. You put it on, you sit there by the fire, and you get emotional about the country. That's not like, hey, I'm fired up about the Leafs right now. Here's my hot Leafs takes.
I know. It's an off-season song.
Yeah, 100%. That is the number one time to listen to Tragically Hip outside of Canada Day is when you are driving to a cottage. Like, that be, it's like that's the soundtrack of you're going to go sit by a lake and drink 100 beers.
That's it right there, buddy.
Yeah, no question about it. Okay, so let's start with this, man. What was your just biggest impression from last night's game?
Florida was just a better team, man. I don't know how to summarize this in one sentence. I was watching both games last night, Toronto and Edmonton. It's just like I see the parallels are eerily similar with both teams. But
that's
in
not
Toronto's
good
because
Edmonton's 3-8 in their last 11. So
it's just like
that's bad. Like that's just so people know, like when they're like parallels with Edmonton, that used to be a good thing. That's not right now.
Yes, exactly. It's not if you're not paying attention to Edmonton. They're on an absolute downfall. I just thought their big guys weren't good enough last night. Like, for their hockey team. They took a couple dumb penalties. Big guys got to come through at the end. I thought they should have capitalized on Max's fight and goal and game in general a little more, build off that. But quite simply, I thought Florida was just a better team.
Yeah. I wasn't really actually planning to go with this one, but so the Leafs have had fights in five of their last six games or four of their last five games. Can't remember exactly what it is, but it's a figure that's like that. But now we've seen it a couple of times, and I would say three specifically, like the Sharks game where there's a fight and the Sharks do better with the momentum. The Panthers fight and the Panthers do better with the momentum. And obviously, Simon Benoit trying to have a Superman punch against Utah, the Utah does better with the momentum. Again, it's three games where I'm isolating this. But do you think there's anything to that? Like, hey, the Leafs waking up the other team and them not being able to rise in that moment or feed off of that the same way that other teams do?
Buddy, I had that written in my notes as something. I'm on the Hockey Night panel tomorrow, Saturday. Yeah, Saturday. Today's Friday. Yeah, tomorrow. That's exciting. I did this for a living for 11 years. And I think with fighting, me personally, I always had to be a little cognizant and was a little nervous about the momentum swing that it might cause. So like, for example, last night with Domes, you would think that would stir up the Toronto fans, get the bench going, but it doesn't necessarily work that way every time. And that's why I used to get nervous about it, because when you're on the road, let's say you're in Florida, you're on the road. When the fight happens, you're not fighting for anybody but your teammates. And I can tell you, if you see a teammate get the wheels beat off him right there, the momentum can swing the other way just as fast as it can swing yours. And your boys on your bench can go, hey, this is nothing against Max Domi, but boys might go, hey, are we going to let Max Domi run all over us right now? Like, are we going to let him take over this hockey game? I was always nervous about it on the road, but at home you have your fans behind you, you have your boys behind you, but you got to watch the momentum swings because it can go either way. And that, I didn't tiptoe into them, but on the road I was a little more eerie of doing them. But I think last night was a situation that's what I saw was like, on paper, it should fire the home team up, the crowd, the boys. But I think a visiting team or the other side of the fight can rally around it just as much as the home side. Like, that's kind of what I saw last night.
Well, it's hard not to think about it when, again, it's in the context of just recency. And that's why I'm asking if it's biased, and that's why it's, like, great perspective to be able to get from you because, yeah, you want to put it off as like, oh, okay, it's three games and maybe it's overplay. But it's like, no, it's very clear that all those teams did rise to that moment. I will say, though, the part of – I think one of the things that was lost in terms of crushers for the Leafs in that spot is Domi fights. And that is as hot as I've seen the crowd all year, right? It's a home crowd for a big game. And I know Leaf fans take it on the chin for being the library all the time, but that it was loud in there and they responded to it. And
yeah,
it was. And it's like, you know, Toronto, for all the regular season games where it's been lackluster crowds, blah, blah, blah. It's been a lot of tough regular season slogs, but when the chips are down and the game is big, that arena usually does respond, and I felt like that was happening in that moment. And the thing to me that really killed the momentum was just a lack of attention to detail with penalties, and then obviously just getting too emotional with Oliver Ekman-Larsson. Like David Kampf trying to skate through the crease, and then Oliver Ekman-Larsson throwing a sucker punch after, yes, a late whistle, I don't really care. You're in a tight game against the Florida Panthers. Can't really give them that momentum of being able to go up on the power play, especially when you're playing fine 5-on-5. I do worry about that a little bit with the Leafs is like the untimely penalties that we've seen with this team. Like that has been a season long thing. That's not just like a, okay, that's happened over the last couple of games thing.
Well, man, like when two teams like this are so close in the standings and in the game like they were last night, like something that small can make a difference. Like that camp penalty was, man, I was trying to figure out why he took that route. Sometimes when I watch, I try to put myself in the position and I'm like, okay, you're coming out of the corner. Like you see the puck go high. I just don't know why you skate through the crease like that. And OEL was, it's just dumb, right? Like it's a penalty as a coach where you're just like, man, what are we doing here? And he's arguing it, but you just punched him right in the face. Like any ref is going to call that all day. And the amount of guys that Florida have are going to eat that and draw that can be the difference in the game. Like when it's that close, discipline is like a huge factor. And I just think that that might have been the difference last night. And going forward, like if you're going to play, you got two more matchups against them in early April. And if you want to win anything down the line, you're probably going to have to go through a playoff series against them. That could be it. So you got to stand on the box, man. Put your pride aside every now and then. And you can't be taking twos like that. It kills you.
Yeah, honestly, dude, it's just like that's the feeling of this game. And I get it. Like there's definitely people who are saying they're 4 points back of Florida. They've got a game in hand. They've got two games against them. There's still 17 games left in the schedule. If you look at the numbers, 5-on-5, they were fairly even, blah, 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 blah. The reason why this is so deflating is context does matter. And the context of the recent stretch of play and what we've seen from this team in the past, and just watching a Florida team that's without two of their best players and going to add Marchand to their lineup, and just the way that they were still able to handle Toronto and the power play getting tight and the goaltending being slightly better for the other team. Like you said it when you were like, hey, they were just better. Yeah, they were better, but they also were down a goal without those key guys. And it's just impossible for me to just sit here today and go, yeah, okay, these are the things that made Toronto fine. These are the things that made them great. And yeah, I think it's just like driving you nuts. And for that team, I do wonder how they're going to be wearing this over the next stretch. Like they've got this game against Ottawa Saturday night, and the Sens are red hot and they love playing the Leafs, right? They've thrived playing the Leafs in the regular season, and they're probably champing at the bit to play these guys in the postseason potentially. And there's always like the little brother thing that happens with these two franchises. And God, I really do feel like this has the potential to turn ugly pretty quick, and how these guys are going to respond to that.
Oh, 100%. Sens are buzzing right now. They're feeling good. And yeah, you're right. They have played the Leafs extremely good this year and in years past, to be honest.
Yeah, every year.
I love what you said about Florida too. That's no Tkachuk, no Ekblad, no Marchand. I feel like I'm telling you, I was nervous all the time before games. I was nervous about everything. But when you look across at another team, especially this deep in the season, and they're missing a key guy, their key guy, multiple key guys, it always gave you a little bit of nerves. It did for me, because good teams rally around that. The teams like absolutely bear down. And this is a team that wanted to send a message last night. They were like, hey, let's go show them that empty roster. We can still do this. I get the feeling Saturday. Lastly, I actually went to the Leaf game. Saturday was Vancouver Canucks. And I was up there and I was thinking a very similar thing to this was, they are going to come out just flying tonight. And I want to have that feeling with Ottawa as well, but I'm getting the same vibes that here you have another team that's absolutely rolling, coming in. And if you have too many passengers, like you did last night, like Ottawa's rolling four right now, their big guys are scoring, their power play's buzzing, they're getting goaltending. And that's a lot of things you can't say about Toronto.
Well, you know what the biggest one for me in that too, with those guys missing, is like, all right, you don't have Matthew Tkachuk, going to insert Brad Marchand, blah, 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 like going, no Ekblad. It was that, who was the identity player in that game if you had to pick one star? It's Sam Bennett, right? Like, he was the guy that stuck out more than any of the Leafs' big players. Like, would you agree with that? Or
every game he plays, he's adding another, what, I don't know, 100, couple hundred K to his, whatever he is making next year. Four Nations obviously lifted whatever confidence he had going into it. But out of that, he's been an absolute beast. Like, he's all over the ice. Every shift, he makes a difference. Like, he does something out there every shift or every couple shifts that makes a difference for their team. Physical, gets involved. He's always in hard areas. And anytime you see a scrum, you look away for a second, you look up, there's a scrum on TV. He's right in the middle of it. Stirs a drink for that team. And I think, like, the Leafs desperately miss a guy like that. Like, I guess Max did that a little bit last night of what Sam Bennett does, but Sam does that on a nightly basis, right? Like that's an effort that you're going to get every night from him. And he is hitting payload at the perfect time with a cap rise and wherever he's going to sign. Hopefully it's Toronto, but I don't necessarily see that happening. He's an absolute gamer, man. And I know, like, listen, we're projecting to a lot of Leaf fans here, and we're kind of gushing over him, but he is an absolute stud, and he really makes the drink stir for that team.
Well, but it's like, it's in the context, though, of this guy finds ways to impact that game where it's a tightly checked, super close game, 5-on-5, not a ton of space for either team, right? Like, there wasn't a lot. But you have to superimpose it against, and I know that, God, we hold the Stars to such high standards, but you also say, like, yeah, man, that's what the money's for. That's what happens when you're asking for $13, $14, $12 million a season, is these moments. It's not supposed to just be like the cumulative stats over the course of a year. It's supposed to be, hey, when you're playing Florida, are you going to come through and are you going to make something happen in the clutch? And it's hard. I know that everyone is just like going after Matthews, and Marner's had like a spectacular season. We just saw him rise to the occasion at the Four Nations, right? In that big game, him and Sam Bennett together. But you look at, like, he disappeared last night. There was no Mitch Marner in that game. Like, Barkov line ate them up. They were complete no-shows. I thought Matthews was maybe like a more around it, was creating for himself. But look at Sam Bennett in that game versus Mitch Marner in that game, and tell me that you can feel good about those two guys in a playoff series going head-to-head as a Leafs fan.
Oh, not great, to be honest. I think no matter what the context of the game is, Sam's just able to insert himself somewhere in that. And I just, you definitely last night, but man, you know, years past, like, the bigger the game, the more some of the big boys disappear. And like, I remember being on teams, and by the time you get this point in the year, like, you're rolling, but at some point your big boys have to take over. And like, I knew sitting in a room, I'm playing, you know, 8 minutes a game, no special teams. I'm not going to contribute a ton. I want to, but I'm probably not going to. Maybe if there's a scrap or if I need to do something physically to try to swing momentum, but I'm not going to go out there and score a big goal in the third period. And I'd look around and you look to your big guys. I think that rubs down on everyone on the team, man. I really do. I think when third periods arrive and you need big minutes and you need big plays in big moments, like, you can't have guys disappearing. Like, you need those big guys. And I think that rubs down in the dressing room. I just remember putting myself there and looking around and being like, I'm not going to do it. I need one of my boys to go out there and have just a massive shift. And just seems like the bigger the game, the less you see from them.
Yeah, buddy, your goal is finish your checks. Don't make a mistake that ends up with the puck in the back of your net. And
don't take penalties.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just, and then if you can get a shift where you guys are in on the forecheck and you can get a change where the other group can get over the boards and build off of your shift, win, you know, like,
that's
huge
it,
win for the night.
Go and, out there in the third period, get some offensive zone time, start running around, finishing some checks, holding on to the puck a little bit, get a good offensive zone change and let the big boys come over with some tired defenders in the offensive zone. Like, that's a huge shift from your fourth line that you're just not getting enough of. And whether it's the fourth or the third, whatever it is, I don't think you're getting enough of those late in games. When it's crunch time and it comes down to gut check time, there's just too many passengers.
No, way too many. And for years, it's like, oh, the secondary scoring. Well, you know what? It's also been the power play, and the Leafs power play in that game did not look sharp. It was not threatening. It was not like, oh, okay, wow, this is a power play that they're building momentum off of. And like, that's the Stars. And yes, Tavares scored the goal. It's a beautiful play by Nylander at the start of the game. Like, how many other moments in that hockey game were you like, wow, that was a brilliant play from Marner. That was a brilliant play from Nylander. That was an incredible shift for Tavares or for Matthews. Like, Matthews has the one play where he breaks in alone and he puts the puck over the bar. When else were you really noticing him last night? Like, honestly, tell me, like, what was that stuck out from those guys?
No, and I think you brought up a good point, is that power plays are an instance, too, where the big guys can kind of change the narrative and they can go, okay, now we're going to get the boys back here. And listen, I was no power play stud. I didn't play much or any, well, not in the NHL, but much or any in the AHL. But JD, I've sat through 11 years of freaking power play meetings with some of the best coaches in the world and watched some of the best skill players struggle and succeed at power plays. And I can tell you that whenever guys started going into a bit of a slump, I had some really good coaches, especially when the power play went into a slump, it was get the puck to the point or to the side and just start firing. Like, just start absolutely hammering pucks. If they want to be brave and they want to start diving in front of pucks, go for it. Hit them with a 95-mile-an-hour slap shot twice. See if they'll do it again. And I just, it's trying to make too many passes. It's cute plays. I would just love them to just start simplifying and dumbing down the game a bit on the power play. And hopefully, like, that works. I just think, like, the power play is a great instance where those guys can be like, you know what, let's go get the boys a goal here. And if you're not contributing 5-on-5 and you're not doing power play, then, you know, what are you doing?
Well, one of the things that I was really loving about the power play for a little bit was Marner being more aggressive from up top. And the last couple of games and last night specifically, it was like too many pump fakes where he's coming in, guys getting into shooting lanes. And I don't know if part of it is like, you know, he's not a defenseman and he's worried about a shot block and then it going the other way and a shorthanded goal. Like, what, again, I never run a power play. I don't know what it's like to be a player. I don't know what it's like to be in those spots. But it feels like so much of what they're trying to generate, again, is no longer at the front of the net. It's no longer like Matthew Nyes tipping pucks or John Tavares getting into, you know, those dirty areas and chipping one in. It's like Nylander from the wing, Matthews from the wing, taking tough shots from tough angles and a goaltender staring right at it. Like, that's what the power play ultimately feels like it's generating more than anything, again.
Yeah, and I think I go back to just simplifying it a bit. You have one of... You know what, he's young, but I'll call him one of the best net front guys in hockey right now, in Matthew Nyes. Why are you not utilizing that a little more? I just I think, like, what you said with Mitchie is perfect. It's pump fakes, it's overthinking plays, and at the end of the day, it's forcing plays. And that's not what you want to get to in your power play. You don't want to be forcing anything. Start dumbing it down, get back to what works, get back to a little bit of simplicity, and go from there. See if that works, man.
Yeah, and I have liked Marner on the power play in that spot. I do think ultimately that has been when they are the most threatening. But it's like, yeah, man, if you're going to be doing, like, if you're going to be hesitating with the puck or you're going to be making those kind of plays where you're, like, dusting it off and pump faking, that's, like, why Morgan Riley's not on the power play anymore. That's why they moved off of him from power play one and running it as the quarterback at the top. So, yeah, you got to be a little bit more decisive and more of those pucks have to go to the net. And they have to do a better job of utilizing Nyes that way because, yeah, if he's the guy that he was last night where it's like he's trying to make a cute play, a hope pass through the middle, and it turns the other way, it's out of the zone, and it kills the power play, like, that's not it. Then you should be having different personnel in there. Okay, so power play, not great. And like I said, I actually thought from – and, God, this is such a weird thing to say, but from a Matthews Barr standpoint that – I think I used the terminology, like, he was around it last night. It felt like he maybe built off it. He had one of, I thought, his better games from just a – 5-on-5, you noticed him standpoint, and I thought it was his line mates that weren't as good as he was. But ultimately, this almost, like, this is one of the craziest stats that I've ever seen. I'm not even kidding when it comes to the Leafs. Mike DiStefano shared this yesterday. How many goals do you think Auston Matthews has 5-on-5 in his last 16 games? You want to guess?
No, you give it to me, though. It sounds like it's going to be low.
Oh, it's low. It's almost as low as it can possibly get. One.
Oh, boy. That's not good.
One.
You know what? Like, I just – so I bring this to the Oilers every now and then, but I also do watch – like, I watch a lot of Western Conference hockey, and you know Nate as well. Nate and Connor are two guys that I always go back to as in big moments in the third period, they have the ability to take over a hockey game. Like, whether it's one shift or whether it's a big goal, whatever it is, they can literally do that and change the trajectory of a game, like, at a moment's notice. And that's just what I want to see that more from Auston. Like, I want to just see every now and then in big games and big crunch time, just have the ability to take over. You're right. I thought he was better last night, but well, you want to categorize him as a star, as a top five, top 10 player in the league. Those guys have the ability to really change the outcome of a hockey game. And whether it's him and his line or him individually, just haven't seen it a lot.
Well, man, and not just that, you made the point earlier about how the big boys going out and getting it done, it ripples throughout the rest of the lineup. I've been saying this for years, and I will stand by it more than any of my other Leafs opinions. when Matthews is scoring goals, it's not just like, hey, wow, it's the identity of the team. That's what gives them the confidence. That's what gives them the swagger. When he's going around and he does that, like, the Christ pose move, right, when he scores a big goal, when he's doing the, like, drop to a knee and does a big fist pump, that's when I feel like the team plays with different energy, with a different level of confidence. And it's part of the reason why I don't think that they've had playoff success is that he's never been able to translate the dominant, you know, 50-goal-plus scorer that he is in the regular season year over year, the dominant 5-on-5, best 5-on-5 goal scorer since he entered the league, into the postseason the same way that it's been in the regular season. And one of their huge failings, probably one of the most overlooked things, because he's someone that year over year doesn't get criticized the same way. Like, God, he won a Hart Trophy in the McDavid era. We've had conversations about, like, where he stacks up with the guys that you just mentioned. And it's always been like, oh, well, he's in the top three. He was just captain for the United States. And he has not looked like that guy this season. Borny and I were talking about it earlier this week. It's like, there's just an absence to his game that is so noticeable that I don't care what you're putting up the points. I don't care if you're showing the raw numbers of some of these things. It's like, he's just not the same guy. He doesn't have the same pop. And so clearly he's not 100%, right? Like, he's playing through something that they feel like is not going to get worse by playing, I would imagine, but also is probably not going to get better with rest, because otherwise they'd be picking their spots. But it is just crazy to see him play a style where it just, he's missing that. I can't tell you the last time where I watched Matthews and thought what you just said, like, he's really taken over. He's dominant tonight. They have no answer for him. The way that it happens with other stars in the game, God, the way that it happened even with, like, Sam Bennett for stretches in that game.
No, I think you're right. Something's obviously not right. And the reason I ultimately think that is, JD, like, I always try to input myself in personal experiences so that I'm speaking from something I've been through. And obviously I'm not Austin Matthews, but I've played a year on some really, really tough stuff. I can remember my rookie year in Edmonton. I tore my labrum in training camp in my shoulder. And it was one of those things. They were like, hey, we can rehab this. You can probably play the year. We'd have to do some good physio. You really have to stay on top of it. But I don't think we need to go under the knife until after the season. And that year sucked, man. Like, and I understand I'm different roles, different players, but the idea of it is the same thing. And it's carrying an injury with you the entire time, because mentally it gets exhausting, because you're trying to get your body physically ramped up to play 82 and then a couple of playoff series. It just wears on you. And to be honest, that's what I see. He looks exhausted. Like, to me, he looks exhausted mentally. And I understand that feeling, because carrying something with you, whether it's his back or whatever it is going on, it's just exhausting, man. It sucks. I remember how much that year sucked off the ice. There was so much other stuff. I tore it a couple more times, and you're hiding it from, I don't want to say you're hiding it from the media, but you're not giving them every single injury update you have, staying on top of it. I led the NHL in fights as a rookie on a torn labrum, on one shoulder. And it was just a miserable year. Like, it was obviously fun, but carrying that with you is tiresome. And that's kind of what I see with Austin every now and then, is he's tired. He's like, man, I just don't have it. And that kind of sucks to say. I'm sure he has a bunch left in the tank, but it's not easy playing a full 82 and, you know, being that guy for your team with what sounds like some sort of broken back, or I'll say broken. You couldn't play with a broken back, but whatever's bunged up in there.
Can I tell you something though? You know what's good for like when you're exhausted?
What's that?
You know what's good for when you're exhausted?
What's good? Scoring 5-on-5 goals?
I mean, that for sure has got to make you feel at least temporarily better, but it's taking 2 weeks off from work and just going and sitting in the sun and saying, you know, I gotta be right for this postseason run. And one thing I'm not going to be able to shake.
Just seeing this one coming.
It's hard not to, man. And I said, this is what it's going to be. Like, if you go to the Four Nations in a year where you're going to Germany to fix whatever it is, and he comes back, and he comes back in time where it's like the 2 week runway up to the tournament, and then he goes there and he plays in like one of the most intense high flying hockey games that you're ever going to see, and looked great, by the way, in it, was, I thought, Team USA's second best forward. And then you come back and you're talking with your teammate Mitch Marner about how exhausting this tournament was, and then you have to jump right back in it into a schedule where In March, they play 15 games, Luke. 15. That's
every other night.
A lot of,
every other
that's a lot of games. That's a lot of games.
You know what? The Four Nations, though, JD, I just feel like I'm almost going to lean with the boys here, because I think this Four Nations thing was so new. Nobody really knew what it was, but these guys haven't been able, other than some world championships over in Europe at the end of the season after their team loses out, these guys haven't been able to wear their country's colors in, what was it, 9 years. And I know personally that a couple of them, Connor included, were absolutely chomping at the bit for this moment, for this opportunity and that experience. And I almost like that Austin went, because it shows you cares, shows you has a little bit of that competitive spirit in there. And it's like, I just don't think he could sit back on a beach in Cabo and be streaming the Four Nations, watching his guys. I think he just,
I'm not saying it would have been easy.
Yeah, no, I'm just playing devil's advocate almost. And I just think it was such a new, relatively unknown opportunity for these guys. They see all their boys going, and it's like, yeah, would have been tough, but you're right. I think if stuff doesn't go the way it stands and everyone wants it down the line here, that is certainly something that we're going to look back on and have some question marks around.
Well, the thing that I have the added layer of question marks is this offseason, they took the captaincy off of John Tavares' sweater and they put it on yours. And it's hard for me to look at someone and say, like, you're the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and yes, you were going to be the captain for Team USA, but if you can't recover in season, and we're always going to be using the injury excuse, but you also look tired and you were gearing up for this stretch, like, yeah, you put your priority, man. you pretty much made it obvious that the captaincy of the United States is more important to you than the captaincy of your club. And yeah, just, that's not a good feeling if you're a Leafs fan. Sorry. It's an understandable one. Like you mentioned, I get him wanting to play in a big game and for his country and being excited for it. I don't deny any of that. It's just, those are kind of, I think, the hard decisions you have to make as a captain of that team. And like you talk about no sweater for like no USA. I don't think he's ever worn it at a like best. He definitely didn't wear the best on best, but I don't even know if he's ever gone to like a world championships or if it's been since the junior team or whatever. But yeah, this team hasn't won since 1967, and you've had one playoff round win over your tenure here. Probably would have been nice to know that you were going to be able to play at the Olympics the following season and yeah, take care of what you needed to do at home first. Last one, you've been good with the time. You mentioned the Oilers thing, you're watching both games. Yeah, I said it, 3-8 in their last 11. Oilers have had stretches like this. Normally they're earlier in the year, right? Where people press the panic button, a coach gets fired, people ask what's wrong with the Oilers. Same to Toronto, where it's familiar narratives, right? Is the goaltending good enough? Is their depth scoring enough? Is the blue line good enough? This year there's an added component of like, hey, what's up with McDavid? Why hasn't he been as dominant a force as he normally is? But yeah, you're a very close observer of this team. Where is your feeling right now in terms of how dangerous this is and like whether they're going to be able to just to flip the switch come playoff time?
You know what, man? We sat there on Wednesday night hockey in the comfy chairs, and the topic was your Stanley Cup contender coming out of the West. And it was only the West because we put in our answers for the East and we all had the same. So we decided to just do the West. Up until Wednesday night when I said Edmonton, I was fully confident behind that answer. And it's 2 days, but I'm already starting to, this is probably like the most concerned I would say I've been about the team since the start of the season. You're going into Jersey last night, a team that has no Hughes, no Hamilton, no Siegenthaler. In the last 10, they had wins against like Philly and Utah and Nashville, but all the big boys they were losing against, they got spanked by Winnipeg, lost to Vegas, Colorado, Dallas. You go in there, this should be like a non-negotiable 2 points. First of all, back-to-back. And what Knobs did was, once again, throw the lines in a blender a bit, the bottom three. But he kept Nuge on the top line. And that's really been the toughest part for that team is last year, and even in parts of early this season, that top line of Nugent Hopkins, McDavid, Hyman could outscore all their problems and could outscore any outcome basically to get the team back in, because they don't get a ton of depth scoring. And now this year, they don't have a ton of depth scoring, and the big line's not scoring again. You want a stat?
Here.
How many goals do you think Ryan Nugent-Hopkins has scored, assisted by McDavid, this entire year? 436 minutes at 5-on-5 they've played together. How many goals has he scored at 5-on-5 by Connor? 436 minutes.
Yeah, and I know how much McDavid's assist numbers have fallen off this year just in terms of what his point. I'm going to play the same way that you should have with me asking you the Matthew stat, which is I'm going to go crazy low. I'm going to say two.
It's one. It's one this year. Yeah, so Nuge's numbers are way, way down. He's on pace for about 50% of his career high, which was a couple years back, 100-something. So last night, what is not decide to do, it's run nuclear. So in the second, he tried it out in the first a little bit after a couple penalties. He's like, let's put the big boys together. It started working. Second, he started running them. By the end of the third period, last night, Connor played 25, almost 26. Leon played 25. Zach played, Hyman played 22. They all played over 10 minutes in the third period. So he's really just trying to run these big guys through the ground, and it's not working. They're not getting scoring. Big guys aren't playing well enough. And last night, all three Jersey goals were point shots that were either tipped or screened. Like, the New Jersey Devils were just owning the net front yesterday. Like, the New Jersey Devils, one of the smallest forward cores in hockey. So they're not defending, they're not scoring, and they're not getting saves when they need to get saves. Like, Skins made an outstanding save on Brad on a 2-on-1 yesterday, but when you need saves, they're not getting them. So it's probably, the most... I don't get super concerned about too many things. I just cover the game. It's not like I have skin in this. But if you're talking about, like, hey, do you think this team is still a cup contender? Like, I'm just not seeing it right now. I know I'm going on here, but their free agent signings haven't been it. Jeff Skinner, Victor Arvidsson haven't contributed much at all. They're trying to find a flow in their bottom six. I think Frederick will help when he's back in. Max Jones has been okay the last couple games. Jake Wallman's been pretty good the last couple games, but they don't look like a cohesive, powerful unit right now.
Yeah, listen, and when you're talking about skin in the game, I think everybody after their run last season, even because I've always been a person who doesn't root for the Canadian teams ultimately, like maybe a little bit of a softer spot for Winnipeg because they lost the team and it's such a small market. And I kind of go like, all right, like I don't know any Winnipeg fans. They've never been a problem in my life growing up. I grew up in Western Canada, Northwestern Canada. I knew fans of every ilk, right? You know, you have rivalries with your friends and you don't want to see your friends' teams win, blah, 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 go on down the line. But I just don't know how you could be a fan of the sport and not see to watch Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl make that run last year, be a game away from a Stanley Cup, and to not want to see greatness in these spots and not want to see the best players in the game in the biggest moments in the game. So, yeah, I think there is more equity amongst just hockey fans in general, especially in this country with like what the Oilers are doing. And yeah, I think you nailed it. Like the vibe with that team is off. Like going into the deadline, looking at it because of the Dylan Holloway stuff, because I think Dylan Holloway has 20 goals or 21 goals last I checked. And
well,
when I was comparing him.
It's not even just missing him. He scored his 21st last night.
Okay. So on the Oilers, I'm pretty sure that would be third because I think Hyman maybe has a goal or two more. But after Hyman, there's no other 20 goal scorer. And then you just look through their lineup and it's like, on paper at the very beginning of the season, even when they lost those guys, you thought two things. One, the forward group is so deep and you thought, oh, like Skinner's going to work here and, oh, they're just going to be able to get something out of Arvidsson and, you know, bringing back Henrique is probably the right call. Like go on that. Hey, Janmark came off this awesome playoff run. You're going to get more from him. And like, who's the guy that's been above expectation for them this season? Like I would say Draisaitl somehow is still over expectation. Then who? Like, is there another guy on that entire team?
Corey Perry.
Okay.
Maybe, like, because you had said 20 goal scorers, that you're right, they don't. The only guy is Hyman past McDavid and Draisaitl. Two down, the next highest goal scorer is Corey Perry. You're exactly right.
Yeah, that's
right.
Not good. I think he's 40.
Exactly. It's 40-year-old Corey Perry who's leading the charge with 14 goals. Like, I think of guys, I go back to the signings, but you can't put it all on them. Like, Pod Colton hasn't worked. Janmark hasn't been as good as he is. Rico looks not as great as he did in the playoff run last year.
just guys have just underperformed. Even Bush, like Bush 2 weeks ago scored his first power play goal for the Edmonton Oilers, like what, 5 months into the season. Yeah, it's for, he had 10 goals at the time. His 11th was first power play goal. They've missed efforts from all those guys. Like Connor Brown, I love you. He's got 8 goals. They just don't get enough out of that third. I look at Winnipeg. You said Winnipeg. That third line drives their hockey team. Like, yeah. Adam Lowry scores every third game. It's just like the past 29 and 97, there is not a lot to cheer about. And it's tough, man. It's the first year. Well, Knob has only been hired there, but it's the first time with Knobloch where I've really seen him blender the lines, and you can tell he's thinking. Like, he rarely did that last year. He ran lines for 10, 15 games at a time, and every time the Oilers are playing, you see new lines. And it's like he's trying anything, guys in and out of the lineup. And look at Jeff Skinner. Jeff Skinner's back in last night. I think they expected a lot more from him. 11 goals. I think he's got the most he's got the most something. I forgot what stat it was, but just hasn't been good enough, bud. And they're out in the Metro swing right now, trying to pick up some points. So we'll see how they turn out here.
Skinner, though, nice for Sabres fans. Like, it's nice to have one guy that left there who's not playing well. So, it's one guy instead of him having be a 100-point scorer playing with Connor McDavid all year. Hey, Luke, you're super generous with the time. Thanks so much for doing it today, buddy.
Yeah, anytime, JT. Oh, GD, have a good day, bud. Yeah.
See you, bud. Luke Gazdick, NHL on SN. Okay, that line in the blender thing, I want to close with that point. See, that's better, Brando. Rancid. That fires me up. Okay, what I was trying to say there, but the boys correctly sent me to break because we needed to do it, is Luke was talking about how the Oilers are throwing their lines in a blender over and over, kind of trying to search for it. And Berube's an even-keel guy, right? And there's not a lot of panic there. We see emotion, but we don't see him throwing guys on the bus. Even yesterday, he's like, I just see a group that's exhausted or tired or needs a break, whatever. They practiced for the first time in basically forever. Yesterday, they were on the road. They had a lengthy schedule. There's four nations, all this different stuff. He's been very, very, very soft on these guys through the media. And I think that's fair to take that approach. I get that people want to hear some criticism. I think that there is a real value in this city in using the media to call out players, using a quote, a public motivation for a guy, but it's not his style. I don't think it ever really has been, but I don't think that it's his style right now specifically. One, he had a tough experience with it, I think with Jordan Kyrou in St. Louis, where he kind of seemed to lose the player based on it. But also, he replaced Sheldon Keefe, and he's doing a lot of the same things Sheldon Keefe is, by the way. But one of the differences is he's not as open with the quotes. I really can't tell you a time where he's been how many times have I played a Berube clip on this show? How many times have you listened to Leafs Talk as well? You subscribe to both, and I love you for it. Have you heard me read one of his quotes from a media conference? It's like very, 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 very vanilla. Not a lot there, right? Good communicator, but not someone who's going to give you some juicy headlines. Not so far anyways. So that's fine. But accountability culture was a huge thing with this team. And when Austin Matthews has one goal 5-on-5 in 16 games, maybe. And Mitch Marner no-shows in a game against the Florida Panthers, that you desperately need him to be the Mitch Marner, not that Mitch Marner. Actually, that depends on what you think the Mitch Marner means. That's like a Rorschach test. What does it mean to you? Time to get a little bit more aggressive with the line blending stuff. Like, you did add Scott Laughton at the deadline, and no, is he Braden Schenn from the standpoint of, like, you feel super comfortable putting a star on his wing? Is he supposed to be kind of like a primary checking forward who can add some goal scoring rather than like a real playmaker? But no, but still, this is a guy who can get to the front of the net. This is a guy who can dig a puck out. This is a guy who you're going to win the minutes with. So try him with somebody else. Let me take a look at it, because yesterday the lines did not have a real force, a real impact to them 5-on-5. And frankly, I thought Lawton was better in that game than he has been in the previous two with Toronto. I think that Carlo fits actually a bit like a glove. He's been a real positive for this team just in terms of like having a steady presence out there, not doing too much. Like, again, a ceiling lifter, not like a game changer. I think that's pretty clear. But let me see some diversity in the lineup. And the main case for this is plain as day, which is if Austin Matthews has gone 16 games with one 5-on-5 goal and he's got three goals over that stretch, what do you have to lose here, right? Like, don't you want to see what Mitch Marner looks like independent of him again? Don't you just, isn't there a point where you just go, hey, this, you're not, what are you losing? Switch it up. Hey, they're hard matching you with Barkov. He's the best defensive center in the NHL. He is 100% the game changer when it comes to being able to bottle up a line. Spread it out. Give it a different look. Try it, for God's sakes. Because if you're Mitch and you're Matthews, I get it if you're Matthews and you're already dealing with something and you're trying to battle through it, you're not feeling super confident that they take the primary playmaker off your wing, who cares? You become more of a playmaker. If you can't score, maybe you got to dish it to some guys. Put them with William Nylander. I don't care. Give me something different. And let me see that level of accountability actually applied to the ice. Because we talked about it when the power play was struggling and they eventually did it. So good for them. Good for Berube and good for Zavard that they looked at it and they said, you know what? We're going with five forwards. We're pivoting. They've done it with ice time with certain players. But with the main guys, it's kind of been a lot of the exact same thing. And right now, when you're in a rut and you don't look the same and you're feeling like you're exhausted, give these guys a different look. Don't make it panicky. Make it for the benefit of the team. Like, the Oilers are searching. And sometimes it becomes too much. We've seen that where it's like you become changing it so much that you don't let guys get comfortable. They are trying to work in a few more players. They are trying to get Matthews going. Let me see something different. Anyways, have a great weekend. See you on Leafs Talk Saturday. See you back here on Monday.